session number 9173, reel 6.
John Medway, tape 6.
Anyway, after further toing and froing between Noel Baker and the Archbishop and the Governor, Noel Baker decided or advised that Macarius was ready for a deal, for a settlement. I think perhaps in Government House people were a bit doubtful about this, but still, Noel Baker presumably knew what he was doing. He had a certain degree of confidence from Lennox Boyd and the Prime Minister in London, and so a message was sent from Noel Baker to Lennox Boyd saying he thought that the prospects were now good, that it was possible to tie up a deal, but that it would be necessary for Lennox Boyd to come out and do it on the spot directly with the Archbishop. Well, of course, it's a pretty crucial step in these circumstances for a minister to go out on the ground and confront the adversary. It must mean that the problem has been settled, and that it was just a question of signalling agreement. When Lennox Boyd got there and the message went to the Archbishop and so on, it soon emerged that agreement was not in sight, and so Lennox Boyd had a wasted a journey and had been put in an embarrassing a position, and he wasn't at all pleased. I remember I happened to be in Government House the morning that he was seeing Francis Noel Baker in the Governor's office, and you could hear the thunder along the corridors. So that failed. And the negotiations were broken off. The Archbishop actually broke off the negotiations, saying that he'd gone as far as he could, and he couldn't resume them until the British had given way on his three sticking points: the amnesty, the form of internal government, and the question of internal security. And so he said there were no further negotiations in prospect. The British simply published their version of what had happened and put the blame on the Archbishop's intransigence.
How soon after the failure of the negotiations was Macarius deported?
It was really quite soon. I can't quite recall, but I think it was just a matter of perhaps a couple of weeks, something like that. It may have been a little more. I can't remember.
Were you involved at all with that decision, Mr. Medway?
Well, of course, the possibility of deportation had been discussed time and again on previous occasions when there had been, in the 1930s, when there'd been an outbreak of violence. We'd deported the then Archbishop. And it was not unheard of in colonial affairs. Of course, when a leader went too far in what was regarded on our side as sedition. But although it had been discussed, it was just in a sort of general way, and I imagine in the colonial office too, they had talked about the possibility. But the decision itself was not the kind of political decision which is reached as a result of a lot of careful minuting by civil servants and discussion of pros and cons and so on. It was essentially a decision by the British ministers concerned, that is, the Prime Minister Anthony Eden and the Colonial Secretary Lennox Boyd, in consultation with the governor. The decision has been, and was at the time, criticised really on two grounds. First, that it was not justified, such action against the man in the Archbishop's position on the record, and secondly, that it was politically expedient inexpedient because it removed the only interlocutor with whom the governor could negotiate. On the first ground, the British published their justification for the deportation at the time when it occurred, and it was, I think, a pretty convincing record of the Archbishop's complicity in EOCA, but it was certainly, it could fairly be said, that at that stage the evidence was very largely circumstantial. The use of the church, of church premises, the church youth organization, priests and so on, without perhaps directly implicating the Archbishop to any very considerable extent. But of course he was the head of the church and the whole Enesis movement, and there were more specific pieces of evidence at that time. Intelligence was beginning to come in about his deep personal complicity, and but it was from intelligent sources and not always the sort of thing that one could, at that stage anyway, publish. But of course, circumstantial evidence is not necessarily wrong or false. And in this case, the accuracy of the evidence was fully confirmed not long after, when the first of the grievous diaries were captured, which showed how deeply implicated the Archbishop was personally. And of course, now, looking back on it all, with Grievous's memoirs published after his return to Athens, it is perfectly clear that the action of deportation was fully justified. There remains the question of whether it was expedient, and this is an awkward one. Was it wise for the British to humiliate the Archbishop and the Church and, if you like, the whole Greek Cypriot people by exiling their leader, particularly one as popular and charismatic as Makarios certainly was? A difficult one, and there's no doubt whatsoever that this, more than any other single factor, turned the Greek Cypriots at large against the British administration. Their emotional reaction, their resentment against the deportation of the Archbishop, and even people well disposed towards the British administration, made that clear at the time. That coming on top of the intimidation of Greek Cypriots by EOCA, the resentment at the countermeasures that the British were forced to undertake, and of course it is one of the common tactics of any terrorist movement to try and force the enemy into taking countermeasures which will be unpopular with the mass of the people. Then on top of that, the Archbishop's deportation, it was really a watershed, and certainly had the effect for the time being anyway, of turning the Greek Cypriot people at large rather abruptly against the British. But I think, then of course it says, said, well, if you're going to talk to them, you have to talk to the leaders, once you'd got rid of Makarios, who else was there? You hadn't got anybody. The British said they hoped that more moderate people would emerge, but I don't know whether we really had much hope of that, and certainly it didn't happen in the circumstances prevailing, because of course if anybody had come forward and said they were prepared to talk with the British, they would have been bumped off. So really it seems to me that that on the grounds of expediency, the question to be asked is, what were the alternatives? The security forces were pretty clear that so long as the Archbishop remained there as a figurehead and a cynosure for national sentiment, that it would be more difficult to counter Eoka. And what were the alternatives? Should we have prosecuted him, or to take the Archbishop of the Autocephalous Church of Cyprus and put him in the dock and bring charges of sedition and of terrorism against him? I think we felt that it was not the right way to go about things. The case could no doubt have been proved, and he would presumably have received a prison sentence, but that would have been a pretty unhappy situation to have the Archbishop locked up in prison. Should we have rusticated him to some remote place in Cyprus, where at least he would be available for negotiations if the opportunity occurred, but we would keep him out of the limelight? There were arguments in favour of that course, but the security authorities, I think, understandably, were much against that because of the burden it would have placed on them guarding the Archbishop and preventing attempts to rescue him. And then it would have been difficult to, if he'd remained in Cyprus, to refuse him all contact with his own people. Indeed, self-defeating in a way, because one would want to keep him in touch with the community and hope that he might eventually come round to the view that he'd got to call for a cessation of violence and cooperate to some degree anyway with the British. So it was felt that that wasn't on, though, as I say, there were arguments for it. Exile him and leave him at large. That was a real possibility, but it would have meant that he would have then been based in Athens, stirring up things more from that end, stumping round Europe and America and conducting the struggle, maintaining contact with people in Cyprus. So on the whole, it was felt that the right course was to put him into the Seychelles, where he would remain incommunicado. Looking back on it, who can say what the right decision was. I suppose I didn't mention the alternative, of course, of leaving him at large and not bothering at all. As I say, the security authorities were much against that because of the growing evidence of his complicity, and it was felt that the viability of the whole terrorist campaign depended very much on having him as its figurehead.
And do you think their task was made easier when he was deported?
Certainly not immediately, because of the resentment which it caused among the population at large. And on the political plane, as I say, nobody else was prepared to come forward. I don't think I'd mentioned that before Makarios was deported, and during the course of the negotiations, Harding had decided to round up the leading members of AKEL, of the Communist Party, and lock them up. I'm sure that the justification he had in his mind for that action was to ease the way for the Archbishop to agree to cooperation, to remove the communist leadership who would have seized on, or might have seized on this and denounced the Archbishop for treachery and so on and so forth, to get them out of the way so as to make it easier for the Archbishop to agree. It didn't work out that way, and I'm not sure that that view was really well-founded. At that time, AKEL had stood on the sidelines, had not thrown in their lot with EOKR, indeed had made disapproving noises. They were much more sensible in their leadership and their conduct of affairs than the extreme nationalist leadership, and perhaps it might have been better to leave them alone as a sort of counterbalancing force, political force within the island. However, the decision was taken. In the end, how did it work out? Well, at least we kept the Archbishop out of the way during the worst of the military struggle in the island. It's not impossible, if he'd stayed, that he might have been assassinated, of course, one never knows. But probably not. As it was, by removing him from the scene, in a sense, I think, in a sense, and I expect this is wisdom after the event, we kept him available to turn to negotiate with at a later stage when terrorism had more or less been fought to a standstill. So that, I suppose, again, is some sort of justification for the action that was taken.
Who was the man who succeeded him as ethnarch in Cyprus when he was deported?
Well, the Bishop of Kitium, Anthimos, I think, took over. He was the next senior in the hierarchy. He was a much less significant man and personality than the Archbishop, and one really didn't hear a great deal of him. And obviously he continued the church's leadership in the struggle and liaison with EOKR, but I don't believe that he was given great importance by either EOKR or by the nationalist or the Anarchist movement in general. It may be that if the Bishop of Kyrenia hadn't been deported, I can't really remember whether he would have been the next senior bishop and would have taken over. I think probably was. Anyway, that was another. He was much more extreme than anybody, I think, in the church, and that was a good reason for getting rid of him together with the Archbishop.
You were explaining earlier how Makarios was the head of EOKR so far as political organisation was concerned. Once he was deported, am I right in thinking there were no more political negotiations until after the Harding period?
That's right. That's right. There were there was nobody to negotiate with, because no Greek Cypriots would enter into negotiations. Partly because they wouldn't like to be put in the position of replacing the Archbishop, and more importantly, because they were afraid of getting killed.
How did the Field Marshal respond to the failure of the negotiations?
Well, it was interesting. He wisely saw and never questioned that there was a military solution to the... never subscribed to the view that there was a military solution to the problem in Cyprus. He knew, had it very clearly in his mind, that the solution had to be found on the political plane. Perhaps it was part of his military... characteristic of his military background. But unlike civil servants and politicians who move only rather gradually from one course of action to the other, the Field Marshal had a more of a soldier's approach. You tried Plan A and you pushed it to the limit as far as you could, and if it didn't succeed, then you switched to promptly to Plan B, and tried that out again, pushing it to as far as you possibly could. So within 2 or 3 months of the Archbishop's deportation, he'd thought soberly about all this and had come to the conclusion that no settlement in Cyprus was possible so long as the crucial question of the island's future status was left uncertain and unresolved. So he said, well, maybe we ought to think more about the possibility of conceding Ennosis, but concentrate on the kind of conditions and timing which would be attached to it in order to minimize the damage. And so he did work out in very broad outline and put to London a rather a bold plan, and it says something for his readiness to think the unthinkable, so to speak, that he was prepared to do this within such a short time of the Archbishop's exile. And the suggestions he put to London was that the question of the island's final status should be left for a period of 10 years, and that during that period self-government should be developed. That was a common feature of nearly everybody's thinking about it then. But then at the end of the 10 years, there should be a national a referendum subject to NATO's approval, which would be decided by a majority of 2/3 of the population. Now, that meant, of course, conceding that the Greek Cypriot majority, who were 4/5 of the population, would have the possibility of voting for Ennosis, subject, and this was an important qualification, of course, subject to NATO's having approved the holding of the plebiscite in the first place. And that would be subject also to the retention of bases by Britain in order to discharge its defence responsibilities in the eastern Mediterranean, and also that Britain would remain responsible for the external defence of the island. Well, the British ministers were interested in this, but predictably they said, well, the first thing to do is to try it on the Turks. I think it must have been implied that apart from Britain's conditions attached to an eventual decision by referendum of this kind, I think they must have had it in mind that the Turks also might have demands to make, whether it would be a Turkish base or some protectorate role for the Turkish Cypriots and so on. Anyway, what they got when they tried it on the Turks in Ankara was an outright rejection. That idea was dropped, and we then had to think up Plan C or whatever it was.
Would this now bring us to Lord Radcliffe his proposal.
Yes, indeed. Well, from what I've said, I think it's clear enough that we were moving pretty far down the road of some kind of self-determination, or at least some kind of decision about the final status of the island. But ministers in London felt that in view of the breakdown of the negotiations between Harding and Makarios and of the criticism that there had been about the precise position the British side had taken on particular constitutional provisions, on that it would be wise to get a well thought out set of proposals drawn up and published, which would show the Greek Cypriots what was on offer and what they were missing in turning down the possibility. And so they recruited the formidable intelligence of Lord Radcliffe for the job, and he produced a set of proposals which are very ingenious and really very admirable. The only question was whether they were still relevant. The possibility of separation, constitutional separation between Greeks and Turks, or recognition of the really of the gulf that divided them in constitutional terms, recognition was ruled out of his terms of reference. So necessarily he produced very ingenious proposals for a unitary system of government. But as far as Turkish distrust was concerned, he felt that his job was simply to provide the best minority safeguards that he could devise, not to begin thinking in terms of separate communal legislatures with the Greeks managing their affairs and the Turks managing theirs and so on. That was outside his terms of reference. And in fact, the minority safeguards which he proposed were, I should have thought, pretty effective. They gave a right of appeal to a tribunal of guarantees against discrimination and all that sort of thing, and were perhaps as good as could be devised, but they were no satisfaction. They didn't satisfy the Turks at that stage, and they were also, the proposals were rejected by the Greeks. Well, that was a significant point in the whole development of the affair, because that was the last opportunity that the Greeks were ever to have of accepting a settlement which treated the Turks simply as a minority rather than as an equal partner, or a partner in the future of Cyprus.